Okay. Fighting the evils of PowerPoint. Okay, I'm just going to give a brief talk about the PEAK experiment, which is a telescope dedicated to measuring the polarization of the CMB, and it actually had its first observing season last winter. So I'm not going to say anything about the nature of the CMB polarization because we already heard it and you all know it already. So what I'm mainly going to do is describe the detector we've built and then tell you some of the things we learned from our first observing season. Now, we're still in the process of analyzing data, so I'm not going to give you any like CL plots or anything you really care about. But I will tell you how we've used the data from the first observing season to learn some stuff about how our detector works. And if time permits, I'll tell you some of the things we're planning to do in the future. Okay, but first things first, for those of you who don't know, PEAKS, the clever acronym, stands for Princeton IQU Experiment, where IQU are the Stokes parameters, although it's a bit of a misnomer because we don't measure I at all well and we haven't measured U yet. We're planning to, but... And it's all run by Suzanne Staggs out of Princeton. What? Anyway. So it's all run by Suzanne Staggs out of Princeton. It's got... What? Yes, we... Anyway. Josh Gutterson's a postdoc, has been working with us the last couple of years. Been building this Q-band polarimeter that's going to be working next year, or this year. And Bruce Winstein's a visiting high-energy physicist from the University of Chicago who helped visit us last year and did a lot with the first cut of data analysis. And, of course, we have lots of graduate students and undergrads helping along the way. So, okay, skipping over all the theory stuff. Now, we just heard about Polatron, which is using kilometers to measure the polarization. We're using a very different technique, and we're using a technique similar to the one being used in the polar experiment. And that is, we're using a correlation polarimeter, which, if you like thinking of things this way, it's basically an interferometer with the two telescopes in the same place. And for those of you who don't know how a correlation polarimeter works, just going to run through it quick, the rest of you can go to sleep. You have this electromagnetic field coming at you from the sky, and you can always decompose it into two orthogonal components, EA and EB. But you could as well have decomposed it into two other orthogonal components, which are just given by EA plus EB and EA minus EB. You take those components, send them through your system, where they're amplified up, mixed down, and filtered in a phase-coherent way until they come down to a multiplier, which produces an output voltage proportional to the product of the input fields. EA minus EB, EA plus EB, EA squared minus EB squared. That's the polarization. That's what you want to measure, wrap it up, and go home. That would be if the multiplier was ideal. It's not. It also puts out stuff proportional to this squared and to this squared. And since the polarization is tiny, these offset terms are obnoxious. So to deal with them, you put in a phase switch into one of the arms, which multiplies the signal, the electric field in one of these arms by plus or minus 1, which multiplies this product by plus or minus 1. But doesn't affect these offset terms because they're just the squares. So we modulate our phase at, we switch this phase switch at 4 kilohertz and look for only signals that are modulated at 4 kilohertz. And we can better extract the polarization and also work past 1 over FP of the hertz. So we've actually built one of these polarimeters that operates at W band, and here's the block diagram. And just to run through it quick, we have a simple corrugated feed horn that takes the signal from the sky and puts it into our detector, which is then attached to an OMT, which is what splits our polarizations for us. Then it runs through a nice low-noise hemp amplifier. Oh, just to point, if I didn't say it before, this operates at W-band, 90 gigahertz. Then a filter to define our bandwidth, then a mixer to down-convert. Just to notice, we do the phase switch on the local oscillator lines, because it's much easier to phase switch the narrow band input, this narrow band local oscillator signal, than it is to phase switch to this broadband input signal. And this takes us from 90 gigahertz to 2 to 18 gigahertz, where the signal's much easier to deal with. So then we can, of course, buy lots of parts, and we send it through a couple more amplifiers, then into a splitter, which allows us to pick off some of the signal and send it into a detector diode. This is useful because it allows us to monitor the total power coming through this line, which is useful as a weather monitor and also as a in the various tests I'm going to talk about later on. But the real signal goes into a filter bank, which breaks the signal into three frequency bands before sending it into our multipliers. This is useful because it provides us with some amount of spectral resolution, and also because it's much easier to phase match three lines than try and phase match something over three octaves of bandwidth. Okay, so that's that. So the numbers you actually care about, we observe at W band, we have a frequency range from 84 to 100 gigahertz. This is very broad band for a coherent experiment. And in fact, unfortunately, due to gain slopes and small due to phase shifts, we only get actually 12 gigahertz of effective bandwidth. But that's still pretty big. Now, we're operating at W band because everybody knows that's supposed to be where the polarizations are going to be small, and Josh will talk more about that later. But there were a couple of other reasons we wanted to do it. One was we had these nice hemp amplifiers, which have a relatively small system temperature, around 75 Kelvin. We were hoping for 50, but that's what we got. And if you combine that with 12 gigahertz bandwidth, we get a sensitivity of 1.2 millikelvin root seconds, which is nowhere near as impressive as all the things you've heard before, but what you gonna do? But it's enough. And that's with no atmosphere. With atmosphere, it's a little higher. The other advantage of working at W-band is for coherent experiments, relatively high frequency. So given the same size dish, your beam width is a little smaller. And this is important for us because we're actually using the old dish from the Saskatoon experiment. And if you guys remember that, that had a beam width of about a half a degree, but operated at around 30 gigahertz. Us working at 90 gigahertz, we get a beam width of a quarter of a degree. And that's important because here's our beam, the BL squared of our system. Just to show you that if we have a quarter of degree beam, we have a significant amount of sensitivity to this first Doppler, to this first acoustic peak in polarization. It is a Doppler peak in this case, isn't it? So, ha. In any case, so that's just why we wanted to do that. But, okay, now a couple pretty pictures. I don't know why the color doesn't project, but deal with it. This just shows the front of our, this is just to show you some of our optics. This is the front of our doer, which, and you can see our window through which the horn peers. And that's just to show you that stares out right here at a 1.4 meter off-axis parabolic dish, which then looks straight out on the sky. We have a very clean optic system, no blockage, no moving parts. The only way we can, the way we scan this thing is that it's on a, that we move the whole telescope. It's on a crane bearing that allows us to steer in azimuth, but we're fixed in elevation. And so that, given the sensitivity limits of our system, kind of determines our scan strategy. So here's our scan strategy. We basically look at a single ring 1 degree from the north celestial pole. Basically, which gives us about 24 independent patches on the sky. So basically, here are our detection axes. If we sat at this point all the time, in 24 hours, we'd measure every point on this ring. What we actually do is go back and forth between these two points every few seconds. That not only helps reduce long-term drifts, but also is a nice systematic check, because the signal that's here at one time will be here at another either 16 hours or 18 hours later. I can never remember which way this thing turns. So that's the system. And we actually took this thing and used it to take data, amazingly enough. And to take data, we, of course, took it up to the lovely site of Princeton, New Jersey, on the roof of our own physics building. And we observed from the middle of January till the end of March, and we got basically 35 full 24-hour periods of observing when it wasn't, you know, raining, snowing, icing, sleeting, or any of the other wonderful things it does in New Jersey in the winter. And this just shows our lovely observing site. This big massive object is our ground screen, which is quite massive for our telescope just because we didn't want to see certain foreground objects like this elevator shaft in an evil map building that's off the edge of this page. It's a very evil map building. Okay. So I'm sure I have to convince you how on earth are you that we're not completely insane by trying to measure the polarization from a site as great as Princeton, New Jersey. And so I'm just going to tell you some of the stuff we've learned from our first observing season that makes us think we actually can do some amount, get some measure of the polarization from a site like Princeton. So I'm going to talk a bit about what the sky temperature is like at Princeton and also discuss a bit, what, more importantly, what the stability atmosphere is like at Princeton and how that affects us as a polarization experiment. And then just briefly say some of the things we've done to characterize our actual detector, which is using Jupiter observations to get the beam and using a chopping plate to calibrate our system. So just sky temperatures. Obviously, these are not the most impressive sky temperatures you've ever seen. This just shows the distribution of sky temperature for different periods during the observing run. These are days of the year 2000, so January, March. And as you see, as time's gone on, the sky temperature's gotten worse and worse. But most of the time, it's between 30 and 50 Kelvin, which is not horrible for us, given our hemp noise is already 75 Kelvin. Yeah, this was measured with the radiometer itself using the total power channel. So this isn't the zenith temperature. This is the actual temperature of the sky. So this just shows that, you know, it's not like we're spending all of our time at horrible weather patterns. Not much. I mean, yeah, there isn't a, I mean, there's, it's not, I mean, these things are obviously when clouds are going through and such things. It's not, there's not a really huge difference between day and night. No. It doesn't drive things nuts. No, we're fortunately looking north. The sun is behind us and our ground screen blocks it most of the winter. So in any case, it's not the temperature of the sky that matters as much as the structure of the sky for CMB experiments. It's the variations in the sky signal as time and space, which makes measuring the temperature anisotropy from sites like Princeton hard, impossible. But since we're a polarimeter and we're measuring polarization and the atmosphere is unpolarized, we should not have to care about that because the atmosphere is unpolarized, we're measuring polarization, we shouldn't see anything. Well, unfortunately, it's not quite true because we're not a perfect polarimeter, but we're close. So to look at the structure of the sky, I took basically a day and a half worth of data in the middle of February, which was just a nice continuous stretch of data where there wasn't like a cloud or something going through interrupting the time stream, so I could make power spectrum. So this is a power spectrum of some of our data. Don't freak out too much yet. Notice the y-axis, if you can read it, it goes from 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 5 hertz. This is time scales of minutes to days. This is the power spectrum of one of this total power channel that's monitoring the weather. It's completely unchopped. And so it's horribly dominated by 1 over F noise, as you well expect, which is a combination of the 1 over F noise from the hemp and the 1 over F noise from the atmosphere. And we haven't fully figured out how much of each is contributing to this. Now, in principle, doing a phase switch at 4 kilohertz gets us out past the 1 over F of the hemps, and also, since that means we're only measuring polarization, we shouldn't see any 1 over F noise from the atmosphere. Well, unfortunately, the OMT that couples our two polarizations is not perfectly isolating. So we are, and that crosstalk means we're somewhat sensitive to the absolute temperature of the atmosphere, which is unfortunate, but it's small. And so if you look at the power spectrum of one of our polarization channels, which is this one, it's still at the 1 over F part, but it's considerably smaller. It's a full 2 orders of magnitude down. This is spectral density, not power spectrum. And even better, it's not only that, it's beginning to knee over here at timescales of about 100 seconds, at timescales of 10 to the minus 3 hertz, that's 10 minutes. So we actually chop at 10 on timescales of 10 seconds. So we can chop way, we're chopping way out here, we could have actually chopped well on timescales of maybe more like minutes. We didn't. But, and once you do that east-west differencing, your power spectrum looks like this. And as you see, it's flat, nice and flat all the way out to timescales on the order of a day. This is great because this means our system is stable on timescales of a day and integrates down on timescales of a day, which probably means that we can actually do this experiment. And so, now that we think we can do this experiment, we want to know what the heck we're measuring. So just to flash things up quick, this shows our beam as measured by Jupiter, just to show you quickly that it is, in fact, 0.24 degrees. The trick is, this is not Jupiter in polarization. This is Jupiter monitored with those total power channels. We don't see Jupiter strongly in our polarization channels. This is because Jupiter is not strongly polarized at 90 gigahertz. This is a basic problem with observing polarization at 90 gigahertz. That you hear, it's great, there's not supposed to be any strong astrophysical foregrounds. It also means there are no calibrated 90 gigahertz point sources, polarized point sources, for us to use, which is a massive problem because you want to know the gain of your system. You can measure the gain of your detector in the lab with loads and things, but you really want to measure the gain of your optics chain. So how are we going to do that? Well, other people came up with this rather clever. We're using kind of a bizarre technique. We calibrate using a chopping plate. Here's just a cartoon of our system. Here's the doer looking at our dish, which normally would stare off into the sky, into space. When we want to calibrate this thing, we throw a big, huge metal plate in front of it and wiggle it back and forth and bounce the signal off in a different direction. You might wonder, what does this have to do with polarization? Well, if you remember all the way back to basic E&M, the light scattering off a dielectric, the reflection coefficient of light depends on its polarization. So if you have unpolarized light hitting a dielectric, it becomes polarized when it scatters off. Since aluminum is not a perfect conductor, the unpolarized light from the sky scattering off of it gets slightly polarized. In fact, the thermal emission from the plate is slightly polarized. And it turns out if you have this plate up here and it's wiggling back and forth about this axis by about 5 degrees, you get a polarized signal which varies by about 30 millikelvin. And it's truly, which is a nice size signal, and it's truly remarkable as you throw this thing on there, wiggle it back and forth, and in the time stream, you see nice sine waves, which are very nice and clear. And you can easily fit these to an amplitude, and given the temperature and geometry of the plate, and thus figuring out what signal you should get, you can easily get the gain of our system. And these gain measurements are totally consistent with the gain measurements we get from in-lab tests. So with that sort of information, we're now beginning to analyze the real CMB data, and we're working on that. And we should have results at sometime soon. And just to say, at the same time, we're working towards future things. We're probably going to do more observations next year with this existing W-band polarimeter. However, we're hoping to improve it by tuning the HEMTs to get their noise down and fixing the gain slopes to increase our bandwidth, and we're hoping to get at least about a 50% increase in our sensitivity by doing that. At the same time, Josh is building a new Q-band polarimeter that he'll talk about more in a little bit. And hopefully with these sort of prototype systems, we can go to, in the more distant future, go to systems which are, in the project called CAPMAP, which will be a system that involves like 6 W-band horns, 4 Q-band horns, and will measure the polarization over the cap of the North Celestial Pole, and measure both Q and U. So that's all I was going to say. No questions, good. Oh, shoot. Ooh. Oh, shoot. Trying to think. Right, right. I think I could, but I'm just trying to remember what it was. Yeah. Right. Yes. Right, the feature that we now have. That scan strategy meant we only measured Q. We could easily modify the system easily to make it measure U instead. We're planning to make it measure both Q and U eventually. We just haven't done it yet with the data in hand. Never. No. The atmosphere is always contributing a noticeable chunk. Well, the atmosphere doesn't have an average polarization, but you still get the noise. What? Sorry. Yes. Yeah. And you just eventually, it just adds noise in principle. In principle, yes. And we're working on doing things like that. Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. Right. Yeah, like I said, it's mostly a weather monitor. Yeah. No, that's for absolute calibration. We know that we monitor the temperature, and we know you can measure the emissivity offline, or at least know it from when they, the numbers they give you in the books. either one.
practical reasons why you're standing around the
MCC. Right.
But isn't that fairly close to the galaxy? And
thought about that? I haven't thought about it, but it's not. Josh will talk more about that in a bit. Is that it? Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Right, we use the total power channels, which monitor the weather, to do that. It turns out that the temperature of the plate is the dominant factor because the atmosphere is 30 Kelvin, the plate is 300, so that's what does most of it. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. The signal from the sky is 30 Kelvin. We wish it was really 30 Kelvin. That would be great.